Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, writer and analyst at MLB.com, joined by Matt Myers, MLB.com national content editor. On today's show, we're going to take a quick look at the division leaders all around the majors. We're going to look at the interesting things the Houston Astros are doing. We're going to talk about the record Yoan Moncada is trying to break and Jacob deGrom's new approach. Before, as always, we each pick a guy you should know more about and rant and rave. And I've got a good rant. I'm very excited about my rant. Before we get to our opening topic, there were two quick things I wanted to point out. The first thing is, you may or may not have heard, there's a big discussion in baseball these days about sticky substances. We'll get to that later on. But the most prominent name at the moment, I think, is Gerrit Cole being called out by Josh Donaldson. And last night, Gerrit Cole threw his fastball 98.2 miles an hour, the hardest he has ever thrown it against the Twins, which I found deeply funny, just in the sense of, has nothing to do with substances. He got called out. Here's 98 miles an hour that I'm going to strike you out. I don't know, Matt, if you watched the game at all, but I just watched that and it made me laugh. I enjoyed that.
Well, it was also it was appropriate because it was against the Twins and against Donaldson. Yeah. And like, so last week, Donaldson like calls Gerrit Cole out by name as like a person of interest in this whole thing. And then last night he tries to kind of walk it back. He's like, I didn't mean to call out Gerrit Cole. I didn't mean to make him the center of this. He was just the first guy that came to mind. It's like, nice try, buddy.
Yeah, we'll get back to that. One other quick thing I wanted to point out, and this is not worthy of its own topic because it's just like, here's a fascinating stat that I don't have anything else to add on. If you remember, like, what, 3 years ago, I guess, one of the trades that will go down in history as one of the most infamous trades was when the Rays sent Chris Archer to Pittsburgh, and the Rays got back Tyler Glasnow, who's awesome, and Austin Meadows, who is crushing the ball, and Archer wasn't very good, and now he's actually back with the Rays. What people forget is that there was actually another player in that trade. The Rays also got a pitching prospect whose name is Shane Baz, and he was in the low minors and obviously didn't get to play last year. And I just wanted to point out quickly what he is doing right now. He's at Double-A Montgomery for the Rays. He turns 22 years old next week. 32 innings pitched, 49 strikeouts, and 2 walks. So if you think the story on that trade is fully written, I can promise you it can still get worse for Pirates fans. I have nowhere to go from that. Just saw that number and I'm like, I need everybody to know about this because, hey, he's at Double-A. I mean, I don't know. Is he going to come up this year? Maybe next year. But what if he's closing out games? They bring him up as a reliever in the playoffs this year. What if Archer starts a game and Baz comes in behind him? Right? There's so much more to this. It's not over yet. That's it. That's all I got on that. All right. We are at the roughly 60 game point of the schedule, and that's where everything ended last year. And what we want to do is just kind of take a quick look around each division because, you know, we're a little more than a third of the way through the season and, you know, things are getting real. You know, the Twins have probably dug themselves a hole that they will not be coming out of, right? And you've got some teams in other divisions where it's like, yeah, that makes sense. And you got a lot of close races. You look at the six divisions right now, five of them, the division leader is up by no more than 3.5 games. And the sixth one is the American League Central where the White Sox are only up by 4 games. No one is running away with this. Everything is tight. Which means within the space of 2 weeks, potentially, you could see all six divisions having different division leaders. So to start off today, Matt and I are going to take a quick spin around each division and look at who is leading and just kind of make our predictions. Like, will that team end up at the top of the leaderboard? So we're going to start. Let's do the National League East. The Mets have a 3.5 game lead over the Braves, or I should say a collection of guys in Mets uniforms. Did you see who started in the outfield yesterday? Kevin Pillar, Billy McKinney, and I'm going to be totally honest with you here. I saw Williams was in the outfield, and I had to stop and think about this for a while. And then it turned out it was Mason Williams, who I believe was a former Yankee prospect at some point. That is definitely a collection of dudes, and they crushed the Orioles.
Billy McKinney's actually been playing pretty well. He's got some, like, he's a pretty good defender, and he's got some pop, and he's kind of been able to hit some. I think he's hit 4 home runs since joining the Mets, so they've caught a little bit of a lightning in the bottle. They got him in a minor trade. This was right after you'd written that piece of like, here's who the Mets should trade for, and they basically made a trade, but it was just for like a random 4A guy, and that was Billy McKinney, who they've got him on a hot streak. So that's actually kind of worked out pretty well. They worked out well for them in the short term.
Is this the worst division in baseball? we thought it would be one of the most competitive divisions in baseball. And so I picked the Marlins in last and they're in last. And I picked the Nationals in fourth and they're in fourth. The Phillies just look terrible. They just look like a bad baseball team. You know, they're only two games under 500 and they've got some stars, sure, but they look like they have forgotten how to field, run, hit, all of it. The Braves are only 3.5 games out, but they've been wrecked by injuries. Ozuna obviously got arrested for domestic violence and suspended, and I would be shocked if we see him again at any point in the near future. The Braves are in trouble to me, and I hate to count on the Mets, especially because everything they've been so injured. Pete Alonso is out there with like tinfoil hat conspiracy theories. The Mets are always like deeply interesting to me. I hate to rely on them. That's the thing, but I feel like I'm Team Mets, I guess.
Well, there's a couple of things, right? The one thing about the Mets is because of all the rainouts and having their opening series postponed because of, it seems so long.
Wasn't it Washington COVID?
Yes, because of Washington COVID. They've played far fewer games than everyone else in their division. And that's in actuality. And I don't know how you were raised, Mike, but one of like one of the tenets that I was raised by my father that is like has stuck with me is that all I look at is the loss column. You can't make up wins. I mean, you can't make up losses. So only look at the loss column because that's really what matters. And it's relevant here because the Mets are actually six games up in the loss column. So I actually think their lead, at least in my impression, is a little bigger than it appears. Also coupled with the fact that they've been managed to do this with half their team injured. That said, they're about to play 33 games in 31 days. And Carlos Carrasco, they kind of assumed by this point, Carlos Carrasco and maybe Noah Syndergaard would be able to pitch in at some point during this stretch. That appears like it is not going to happen. So the pitching depth is going to be extremely tested during this stretch. And I think we will know a lot more after this stretch of 31 days of where things stand. If they are still up by six games in the loss column, I will feel very strongly about the Mets winning this division. But they've got a four-game series with the Braves coming up, which also could swing things. So I think Mets, just because I think the roster is going to get better. Even if they don't get Carrasco and Syndergaard back soon, they are going to get Jeff McNeil back soon, and then Conforto, and even like Luis Guillerme, and maybe even Brandon Nimmo, and then maybe Brandon Nimmo and JD Davis at some point. So like their roster will improve, and I bet you they will make in-season additions. So like, yes, I think so.
I am going to give you a good news, bad news on the Mets. So the good news is I agree with you, everything you said about the roster getting healthier. The bad news is, as you kind of touched on, so no expectations for Carrasco, right? Syndergaard, who knows? When you look at the rotation, DeGrom, we'll talk about in a minute, it's obviously been phenomenal, right? David Peterson looks terrible. I don't trust Joey Lucchese. And I do like both Taijuan Walker and Marcus Stroman, but I also think, you know, they're maybe overperforming a little bit. Like I don't think the underlying metrics quite support how good they are. You know what I mean? That's not to say like they're going to be bad or anything like that. I'm worried about the middle to back of that rotation, and I'm not sure what they do to fix that. But I think we're in agreement, right? We are both going with the Mets, and famous last words, when has anyone ever, you know, predicted the Mets to do well and then had it blow up in their face? Couldn't be me. The most exciting division to me, I think, maybe not exciting, let's say interesting, is the National League Central, which I guess in one sense has kind of gone as expected, in that the Pirates are like way back and the other four teams are all sort of in a jumble. You know, Cubs are leading right now. We're recording this on Thursday morning, by the way. There are four teams within 4.5 games. Cubs are first, Brewers are a half game back, Cardinals in third, Reds in fourth. And I picked the Brewers to win this division. You picked the Reds, didn't you?
I think that's, I did. Right.
Yeah. See, I pay attention to what you say every now and then. The Cubs have been fascinating. We talked about them a lot last week. I don't trust the rotation at all. The bullpen's been spectacular. Some of the guys in the lineup have really like had nice comebacks. Bryant looks great. Patrick Wisdom is still hitting. I'm really digging that. But I'm still going to go with the Brewers, because that Brewers pitching staff, which is kind of what we talked about before the season, is ridiculous. Like, Jacob DeGrom is so good. He's so good. And I feel like I can argue that Corbin Burnes is on the same level as him, right? Brandon Woodruff could be a Cy Young contender. He is not the best pitcher on his own staff. And oh yeah, Freddie Peralta has 92 strikeouts in 64 innings. You know, this pitching staff is also Josh Hader and Devin Williams. If they can just find like one guy who can hit, you know, I like they traded for Willie Peralta. I like that. Maybe Jackie Bradley will wake up. Maybe not. I don't feel great about anybody. I'm sticking with the Brewers because now with Jack Flaherty out, I don't trust the Cardinals like at all.
Yeah, I mean the Reds have been playing well again, so I really want to be excited about my pick of like, hey, they can do it. They've won 7 of 10, but of course, in like, you know, Nick Castellanos and Jesse Winker have both been incredible, but now Sonny Gray goes on the IL, and it's just like it feels like one step forward, one step back. So I think I'm just worried about the Brewers offense because I don't know if we're ever going to see the old Christian Yelich again. I'm not saying we won't. But this is one of those tough ones because 2019 was the shortened season and it's like, but it's been like a while since we've seen like, you know, the MVP level. It's been since 2019, right? And we haven't really seen that guy yet. And the underlying metrics are still pretty good, but they're not like what you saw in 2018, 2019. And without like peak level Yelich, it's just... I think I'm sticking with the Cubs. I still think the Cubs have enough of high level talent, and I wouldn't be surprised if they do make. I mean, we joke about them trading away. They could use a pitcher like Yu Darvish, but like I think they will make some sort of deal to improve their pitching staff. So I'm going to stick with the Cubs.
How about this? This is what they have done. Is I think we can all stop talking about whether they'll trade Chris Bryant, right?
Correct.
Like they could not possibly do that. This unless they like totally collapse over the next month or so, which I guess is possible here. I'm going to stick with the Brewers, but I'm trying quickly to look this up. Okay. So the Cubs end their season against the Cardinals and the Pirates. That's not as interesting as I'd hoped it would be, but this division is going to come down to the very, very end of the season. Like, I think we're going to be on, September 29th or whatever it is and saying, I wonder who's going to win this division. Okay. The Brewers end with, the Brewers have a fun schedule. Starting September 17th, 3 at the Cubs, 4 with the Cardinals, 3 versus the Mets, and 3 more with the Cardinals. That's going
to
be fun.
I look forward to that.
That's going to be great. Okay. NL West, believe it or not, the Giants are still on top, but still. And, they're up by 2 over the Dodgers, and they're up by 2.5 over the Padres, and the other two teams are irrelevant, mostly. I've said this multiple times, like, pretty high in the Giants coming in, didn't think it would translate into wins and losses. I still don't trust them to hold up over those other two teams over the course of a 6-month season. But let me throw this at you. We had looked at the East and said, okay, 4 competitive teams, maybe 5 if you like the Marlins. We looked at the Central and we said 4 competitive teams. And I think a lot of people thought that the first wild card would come out of the West, probably the Padres. And the second wild card would come out of one of the other two divisions. It's not out of the question that both wild cards are in the West, right? Like that's, I think, what it would be right now if the season ended. Let's hypothetically say the Dodgers win the division, Giants, Padres in the wild card. That would be fun.
Yeah, no, I think if you go by like, the Fangraphs playoff odds, that is the, even now that's like the projection is the Giants and the Padres are the wild card teams. I mean, the Giants I don't know if cushion is the right word, but they definitely, are out front of not just their division, but also in the wild card chase. I do worry about the depth at this point. I still think they're in a great position to make the wild card, but I'm not going to change my feeling that it will eventually be the Dodgers. They're just too, the depth they have. And when you see all the injuries across baseball, like just the depth they have, I think will not the combination of depth and high end talent will kind of eventually allow them to pull away. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see them challenge 116 wins as it looked like we might about 2 weeks into the season, but I'm not going to, I'll stay with Dodgers.
I was watching the Giants game yesterday. They were playing Texas and they had back-to-back home runs from Jason Vosler and Chadwick Trump. And those are not exactly household names. So they're doing a good job at getting production from unexpected places. I agree with you, by the way, on the West. All right, let's go to the East, the American League East. The Rays are up by 1.5 over Boston. Yankees are 5.5 back. This is kind of fun. The Jays are in fourth place, 6 games out, but they're also 3 games over 500. This is like the best, most competitive division, I think. Forget the Orioles for now. The Yankees, as we read about, have not been able to hit, although I can't imagine that continues all season long. The Red Sox, they got off to this wild start. I think we dug deeply into the Rays last week, right? Saying like everybody hated them for the Snell trade, but actually they're really good. And I'm in on the Jays. Like Robbie Ray is throwing strikes now. All, it was just like, hey, what if you threw strikes? And he said, okay, I'm going to go do that. And he looks amazing. He was throwing his slider at like 91 the other day. And, you know, Vlad Jr. might win MVP. And, you know, George Springer presumably will play at some point. You know, they're in fourth place. And I actually, like, I'm pretty in on the Jays. I think I'm going to stick with the Rays, but I have not a great deal of confidence in this, to be honest with you.
The biggest reason for the Rays is sort of almost like, you know, you mentioned Shane Baz, and they also have Wander Franco in the minors. Like, they have like guys who could come up and really improve their roster. Obviously, anytime you call up a prospect, there's still a little bit of like a unknown. You know, a lot of guys struggle because it's really tough to go from AAA or AA to the majors. So you can assume that they're going to hit the ground running like, you know, the likes of, you know, Acuna and Soto did. But the cushion they have on the Yankees is real. I sort of think the Yankees will end up passing the Sox. Although, of course, Chris Sale is another huge X factor. It's like, is he going to give the Red Sox anything? And like, could he, you know, even if it's as like a, you know, they say it wouldn't be, they're going to use him as a starter and not as a reliever, but maybe it could be in sort of like a long man stopper role, which he did do early in his career. If it was a little closer, I'd say the Yankees. But the Rays are good enough that even now, like you said, you know, five games is actually, when you're talking about, you know, true talent levels, and like, it's hard to make up five games when you're not like obviously better than the team in front of you. And I don't think the Yankees are obviously better than the Rays, but I do think it's going to be close.
I agree with you, but I'm going to stick with the Rays. This one's going to be a lot of fun to watch. If we go to the Central, I think this is the one that I am the most confident in. The White Sox are up by four games over Cleveland. The Twins are 13 games out. They look a wreck. Like, I kept thinking, that's a slow start. They'll get Buxton back. The hitting's actually been pretty good, but the pitching staff is, they're done. I don't think they can come back, right? Detroit's not great. I was never in on Kansas City, and they're 7.5 games out. Cleveland, I'm moderately impressed that they have played this well. And as expected, their offense has been, Jose Ramirez is really good. Franmil Reyes has been pretty good. And that's like it, pretty much. What's surprising to me about Cleveland is they have had, due to injuries, something like a two-man rotation recently. Like, Shane Bieber's been great. Aaron Savali's been pretty good. If you look at like who has started their last couple of games, it's been Giancarlos Mejia, Cal Quantrill is in there, Tristan McKenzie every now and then, Sam Henches, Eli Morgan. I can be honest and say I did not know all those names like 2 weeks ago. You know, and they'll get healthy, but not healthy enough because I don't think that they can hit. And for all of the things we've said about Tony La Russa, the White Sox are a really good team. I will note that ever since he called out Yermín Mercedes, Yermín's hitting like 180. So there's that. But Lance Lynn looks amazing, right? Giolito's good. Keuchel's good. Cease's looked good.
Carlos Rodon throws like 100 now.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly right. I'm in on the White Sox. Like, this team is legit.
Yeah, I've been high on the White Sox for a while, so it's good to see them kind of living up to that. And it's, you know, in some ways it's like they could be in a position where also they have a cushion, and then coming down the stretch, will they get anything out of Eloy Jimenez or Luis Robert going into the playoffs? And they could actually get like an internal boost just from like the IL that can make them way more dangerous in October.
You know what a reputation I've cultivated for myself is that over the weekend, we went to like a one-year-old's birthday party. I think it was on Sunday. And so I was not watching baseball that day. I was chasing my kids around the park, and it was wonderful. And so being totally, blacked out from what was happening with baseball, at a certain point in the day, I received like three different text messages about, what was that bunt? Did you see that bunt? Why did they bunt? And it was after Derek Holland had let like four straight guys on. And then they had, I think it was Danny Mendick bunt, and it was, it went poorly and they lost the game. So I appreciate that my baseball friends think of me in that way. And then the West, this one's fun too. I mean, all the races are really fun, actually. Oakland's up by one over Houston. Seattle, the Angels, and Texas, none of them really have a chance. Although, have you noticed the Angels have been winning games since Mike Trout?
I know. It's really amazing.
I can't say I've paid much attention to anything Bill Simmons has done in a long time, but it's fun to go back to the Ewing theory, because that's sort of what's happening here.
Don't get me started on the Ewing theory, Mike. We can go on a real tangent here. So let's stay on baseball.
I don't want to dig in too deeply into the Astros because that's like our whole next topic here. But I'm in on the Astros. I like Oakland. I like what they're doing a lot. I'm super in on the Astros, and we're going to talk about them in a minute. So I'm going to cede this time to you, American League West.
I'm a little torn on this one because I think like it's a little bit of a TBD because I think like the most A's move possible, I think, is for them to trade for Trevor Story at the deadline. It's just like a peak A's move. They've done this before time and again where there's like, you know what, like we're in it. We're going to trade for a star. We have no intention of resigning because like he fits a need for us right now and he's going to make us a lot better. And it's probably not going to cost us that much, right? Like because it's a rental and rentals generally don't cost that much these days. So this is one of those where without a big move, I'm taking the Astros, but I think the A's have a big move in them. And I'm excited to see what they do. But because since we can't assume a big move, I'll go with Astros. But man, the A's are fun again. It's cool to see Matt Olson like being the hitter that he kind of looked like he could be a couple years ago. You know, his K's are way down. He's really controlling the strike zone. Slugging 571. I can never pronounce. Is it Canna or Canna?
Well, Marcana, I was going to say it's so objective to say to say like who's the most underrated player in baseball, but it's got to be him, right? This is like his fourth straight year of being an above average hitter. Like over the last 4 years, he has a 134 OPS plus, and he plays like four different spots. I'm a huge fan of Marcana,
and he's one of the best bat flippers in the league. He should be more famous. Like it's sort of shocking that he's not. So
when are we going to get him on the list of like best all time Rule 5 guys with Roberto Clemente and Johan Santana?
We may have to do that. I may do it right after we finish recording. I'm sure we have like an evergreen story about best Rule 5 picks. I may have to get that updated right after we record.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and we are going to talk about the Astros because they are fascinating.
Talking about erectile dysfunction isn't easy. Usually, we just brush it off or blame ourselves, saying things like, "I lost my mojo," or we avoid it altogether with excuses like, "I had a long day at work," or "sorry, honey, I'm just not feeling it." But with Roman, it is easy to talk about. With a real healthcare professional who can prescribe real medication, it's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free 2-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/MLB and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/MLB today. If approved, you'll get $15 off your first order of ED treatment. Roman is the official partner of Major League Baseball. That's GetRoman.com/MLB. GetRoman.com/MLB.
Welcome back to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Mike Petrillo and Matt Myers. Our first topic of our three-batter minimum is look at all the interesting things that the Astros are doing. They are one game out of first place in the West, but after starting the season 8-10 since April 22nd, they have the third best record in baseball. And I have to admit, I find this team fascinating. And let me preface this. I'm aware that they're the villains of baseball. I understand some people 50 years from now will look at the players on the Astros then who haven't been born yet now and will hate those guys. Like, totally understood. I am not trying to overlook that. But also Dusty Baker's team is pretty fun. Like, they're the best hitting team in baseball right now, kind of by a lot. They have the most runs scored. They have the best weighted runs created plus at 121, where 100 is league average, and it's the best by a lot. The White Sox are at 112, and that's with two lineup spots being like total black holes. Martin Maldonado is a respected defensive catcher. He has not hit even a little bit. Miles Straw, their starting center fielder, has not hit at all. I can't think of a bigger team need than somebody going out and trading the Astros a center fielder, and I don't know who that's going to be. Now, there's a couple of fun things I wanted to get into here. And the first one was actually noted by our friend and colleague, Andrew Simon, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it because I find it absolutely fascinating. So the Astros, have the, as an offense, have the lowest strikeout rate in baseball this year. And in fact, if you go back to 2017, 150 team seasons, the three lowest strikeout seasons are Astros 2017, Astros this year, and Astros 2019. Now, this is the part that Andrew passed along, which I think is cool. So they have an 18% strikeout rate. The major league average is 24% strikeout rate. And if you go back throughout history, you can't just compare raw strikeout rates because, you know, teams 80 years ago probably struck out like 6% of the time or whatever. But if you compare it to the average for that year, you get an indexed stat. 100 is average for that year. So this year, they have a 76 strikeout rate plus. Think about it like 24% better than average, right? Second best ever, only behind the 1986 Red Sox, which is really interesting to me. It's not a loaded topic at all that the Astros hitters aren't striking out, right? Like no one's gonna have thoughts about this. I want to pat myself on the back a little bit. If you go back to the winter of 2017-18, both myself and 16-17, I can't remember now, whatever. Both myself and Jeff Sullivan, who was writing at Fangraphs at the time, predicted that they would not strike out as much simply because they'd gotten rid of, like, you know, Chris Carter, and they'd imported other guys who, like, some of that was predictable. I understand all the other garbage, totally understand. But it helps when you have Michael Brantley, you know? It helps when you don't have Chris Carter. The fact that they make this kind of historically good contact and continue to do so, it's like, it's a really interesting story that nobody wants to think about because of everything that comes along with it.
And it's, but if you look at the hitters they have on their roster, they seek out these kinds of hitters, right? It's an archetype. You know, the only good hitter they have who fits the modern, like, mold of, like, big K's, you know, middling walk rates is Yordan Alvarez, who strikes out 25% of the time and has a 5% walk rate, right? But, like, all their other good hitters are, like, below league average in strikeout rate. You got Yuli Gurriel, who actually walks more than he strikes out, which is really rare in this day and age. And then you have two guys who are low-key having really good seasons, Jose Altuve and Alex Bregman. You know, Altuve is basically back. And as it turned out, like, his 60-game season last year was kind of a fluke, as you wrote about in the offseason. He was good in the postseason. If you kind of include that, the arc of his year looks a whole lot better. And we have the good Carlos Correa, right, who's, like, picking a good time, being his free agent walk year, to, like, have, to this point, a very good, healthy season. All these guys with well below average strikeout rates. So it's, like, up and down the lineup, like, these are the players they have, like, you know, either drafted and developed or acquired who sort of fit this mold. And I don't think that that's an accident.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by Yuli Gurriel. Right? He's 37 years old, and last year he was terrible. And you kind of thought, okay, well, you know, 36 years old, maybe it's the end of the line, but they brought him back. He's got a 406 on base and a 9% strikeout rate. Like, he's been unbelievably good. And this might be the best offense in baseball, or at least in the American League, which I don't think people would have thought about entering the season, just because, like you said, some of the guys had down years last year. But there's more to it, right? They are the third best field in the team in baseball, if you look at outs above average, behind Tampa Bay and San Francisco, two teams that are also doing very well. I wanted to talk about the pitching for a second. I think when people looked at the Astros pitching staff coming into the season, they thought, okay, Zach Greinke, cool. You know, he's older, but he's still really good. Oh, but Verlander's hurt, and Cole is gone, and Morton's gone, and Keuchel's gone, and all these guys who'd been, like, the part of the championship teams are gone. And if you look at some of these, like, lesser known names, right? So Luis Garcia, Christian Javier, and Jose Urquidy, right? These are not household names, I don't think, in baseball. The three of them combined have a 3.16 ERA. That's just those three guys, right? Not including Greinke, not including Jake Odorizzi, Lance McCullers. Framber Valdez, who was, like, a big breakout guy for me, and then he got hurt. He's only allowed 3 runs in 18 innings since he's come back, right? So that's 7 starters we just named right there. Their rotation is pretty good. You know, it's got the 6th lowest on-base percentage allowed. The bullpen stinks. They need 3 or 4 more relievers. I wanted to just focus on two guys here. Ryan Pressly seems like he's back. You know, 25 strikeouts and 5 walks. And I could have talked about Brooks Raley in my, like, random guy you need to know about segment, but Matt always gives me a hard time about relievers, so I'm just kind of cramming him in here. Here's a quick 30-second overview of Brooks Raley, who's 33 years old. You have no idea who this is. Why would you? He bounced, drafted by the Cubs in 2009, bounced through 4 different teams, spent 5 years in Korea, came back with the Reds last year, was traded to Houston. He has a 6.56 ERA, and you're immediately wondering, why am I talking about this guy? He has a 3.37 expected ERA. He has the lowest hard hit rate in baseball, and he's got an extra 9 inches of break on his slider and 8 on his curveball. I really find him interesting, and I just think the Astros get underrated. I think part of it is their bullpen is thin. I think part of it is people are just sick of the Astros in general because of everything that's happened over the last couple of years. Totally get that. I'd still like to see Dusty Baker win a ring.
Yeah, it's all the controversy. I mean, that's it. Like, no one can – it's, like, hard to have a rational conversation about the Astros. And, like, that is kind of their own doing. Like, they sort of – they come by this honestly or dishonestly, as it were. But, like, it's kind of too bad because they are an interesting team and they have a lot of – really fascinating players. You talked about their lineup of maybe being the best lineup. In some ways, I think what's true about that is that maybe they're not the highest scoring lineup, but it feels like because of the fact that they don't strike out and they're just like, they're tough. They're a lot of tough outs, right? There's not guys where it's like, oh, you know, Yordan Alvarez is the kind of hitter, these like, you know, big power guy, but it's like, you can pitch to him. You know, there are holes in his in like in the zone that you can exploit and you could pitch to him. But like, they don't really have, most teams have like, 4 or 5 of those guys. They basically have 1 or 2 of those guys. And like in the heart of their lineup, that's like one of the hardest like stretch of like 5 or 6 hitters in baseball that you have to go through of really good hitters who also don't really strike out. So to that extent, that's kind of why I think that they're the best, they're the best offense.
The funny thing is, if not for everything that comes along with it, there's a lot of people who would be celebrating that this team doesn't strike out, right? Because exactly. That's what everybody wants.
Exactly.
The last thing on this, I just wanted to point this out. So I was talking about the strikeout plus leaderboard, right? Where comparing themselves to league average, they're the second best strikeout team of all time. If you go to the other end of that and you look at the teams who've struck out like way, 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 way more than league average for that year, you know who's in the top 4? The 1927 Yankees, who struck out a ton. Why didn't they just put the ball in play more? Literally the 1927 Yankees. All right, our second topic here, back to the White Sox. Yoan Moncada is challenging one of the weirdest records in baseball history. Batting average on balls in play. It's like a top level analytic stat. And basically what it means is when you make contact with the ball and you don't hit a home run, what's your average on that? And the idea is that, you know, supposedly helps you get to whether you're finding good or bad luck, right? Are your batted balls finding holes? Are they finding gloves? It bounces around a bit. Like a hitter has some control over it based on the way he hits the ball, based on whether he's fast, based on whether he's shifted or not. But, you know, it fluctuates, you know? So 2 years ago in 2019, Yoan Moncada had this big breakout year. And part of the reason was he had a 406 batting average on balls in play, which at the time was one of the 10 highest seasons ever. And you're like, well, that's cool. It's probably a good luck season. I don't think he can do that again. Last year, he didn't. You know, he was pretty open about the fact that he was affected by COVID and he wasn't strong. And that 406 dropped to 315. And you kind of all thought, okay, that was fun. You know what he's doing this year? 417. He now has 2 of the 11 highest seasons ever. And if you look at the all-time career leaders for batting average and balls in play, minimum of 1,500 plate appearances, he is second. The first guy is Rogers Hornsby, who's a Hall of Famer. The third guy is Harry Heilman, who is kind of a forgotten Hall of Famer. He played with Ty Cobb and the Tigers back in the day. Number 4 is actually Ty Cobb. Number 5 is Rod Carew, and also Yoan Moncada. So I know he hasn't played as long as those guys, and I know he strikes out more, so the profile and the shape are different. This is a skill now, right? This, you don't fluke your way into that, I don't think.
No, because I think, you know, batting average on balls in play, or BABIP, is like, it's become such a focus of defense. It's like so much of like shifting is to try and reduce batting average on balls in play and basically force you to say like, hey, if you're going to, you know, beat our shift, you have to hit it over us, or like, you know, really slug the ball in the gap or over the fence. But like, you're not going to, it's a lot harder to do the old, like, you know, most hitters have like real tendencies, but like, if you are sort of hard to shift against, it's actually a skill, and it's something that like, it's not easy to do. And I don't like when I hear people be like, oh, he should just like spray the balls. Like, it's not that easy, but the hitters who can do it, especially those who can do it with authority, like Moncada, that makes them special. And I think that's why he's one of the more interesting hitters in the league for this reason.
Yeah. So I dug into like, why, like, how does he do it? Like, he's fast, but he's not Billy Hamilton fast. He hits the ball hard, but he's not Giancarlo Stanton. I kind of started with the strikeouts here because if you look at him compared to Rogers Hornsby, right? Rogers Hornsby only struck out 7% of the time in his career. Moncada is like 31%. So Hornsby had like nearly 80% of his plate appearances ending with something in play, while Mankata is like 55%. It's a different sport, right? Like Hornsby didn't play at night or face integrated teams or fly or anything like that. But the thing is, like, a third of Mankata's plate appearances don't end up with something in play, so they don't even count here, and then he hits home runs, those don't count either. But the other thing is, if you look at over the last five seasons, he has literally the lowest weak contact percentage in baseball. Like, he will either miss it or he'll hit it hard. And you might not think that's like the best approach towards being a successful player, and maybe it's not. Maybe he could make more contact, but if you want your balls that you hit to not find gloves, never hitting garbage baseballs is a pretty good way to do it. Like, that's a good start. And then when I dug into it further, so he's a switch hitter. He's two different players entirely. Lefty Mankata, it's almost all earned, right? Like, you look at expected batting average on balls in play based on quality of contact. Well, this is the third highest, and the outcomes are actually the highest. That's because only two lefties in the last 5 years have a higher line drive rate than him. Matt's boy, Luis Arraez, and Freddie Freeman, who might be a Hall of Famer. So, crushing line drives all the time is a good way to find base hits. Righty Mankata is very different. He's actually only got the 93rd highest expected batting average, but the third highest actual batting average on balls in play. And that is because he has almost never shifted. As a righty, he's never shifted. As a lefty, he is, because he does spray the ball over the place. It was kind of fun for me to dig through that and say, he's one man, but two entirely different players. And the final thing I wanted to point out is, over the last 3 years, he does not have the highest batting average on balls in play in baseball. He is second to his teammate, Tim Anderson. The White Sox are super duper weird.
I want to take one moment to pat myself on the back slightly, because Yoan Moncada was my preseason AL MVP pick, thinking he could ride the like best player on a division winner to winning the award. Now, I don't think he will win it at this moment, because he's not hitting enough home runs. He only has five, and I think he'd probably need to get up to at least 20, if not 25, to make a case. But American League leaders in WAR per Fangraphs, he is fourth. So there is a path for him to be best player on a division winning team, but I do think he needs to have some sort of a boost in his home runs, because right now Vlad Guerrero Jr. has the inside track. But again, some voters won't vote for a team that finishes in fourth place, and the Blue Jays might finish in fourth place. So there's a path for Mankata to pull it off. And I obviously want that to happen because I want to sound smart.
I'm going to dispute you a little bit here. When you say he's fourth, you're almost certainly looking at the batting leaderboards, which does not include the entirety of Shohei Ohtani's greatness, right? I mean, it's the top two are pretty clearly Ohtani and Vlad Jr. right now.
Yeah, but I think that Ohtani's, I guess to your point, yes, Ohtani will suffer from the same, potentially from the same fate of being on a fourth place team, but he may have the shiny new, again, I don't think he's going to win, but I do think he's at a very good path to being in a top five guy, which also would make me feel smart anyway. So I'll take it.
Anything we can do to make you feel smart on the show would be good. All right. Our third topic, Jake DeGrom is obviously phenomenal. He's doing things a little differently. So if you've paid any attention to baseball this year, you know Jake DeGrom is just crushing people. 58 innings, 93 strikeouts, 8 walks, 4 earned runs. He has a 0.62 ERA. We are not that far away from like seriously needing to sit down and do the math and say, will he top Bob Gibson's 1.12 ERA, which is not actually the record. You know, there are lower ERAs from 100 years ago, but that's like the modern day record people care about. My favorite all-time baseball stat, Bob Gibson had a 1.12 ERA and lost 9 games in 1968. DeGrom has over his last 3 starts that he's made are his 3 hardest 4-seam fastball velocities of his career. His last 2 starts each averaged over 100 miles an hour. Averaged, not just like once. His last start, 100.4 miles per hour on average. And oh yes, he can throw it with pinpoint accuracy. And Matt, you had come up with something interesting. Because he's doing that, because his fastball is so deeply good, he's just basically become like a 2.5 pitch pitcher because he can.
Yeah, I had known he was going to be, he was throwing his fastball more because he's added like velocity again this year, which he seems to be doing every year. And then I was watching him pitch against the Padres last Saturday night, I guess it was. And it was like, you know, I'd always thought DeGrom, I was always a big fan of his changeup. I just like, it's just a very well-executed pitch that often made hitters look completely foolish. And I was like, he's not really throwing his changeup this game. And then I went and looked at his Baseball Savant page, and I was surprised to see the extent to which he's become not just fastball dominant, but basically just like not really throwing his changeup that much anymore at all. So here's an example. So 2018 was his best year to date. That was his first Cy Young season, 1.70 ERA. He was incredible. That year, he threw his fastball 43% of the time, four-seamer that is, slider 24, changeup 16, two-seam or sinker 9%, and curveball 8%. So he was basically a five-pitch pitcher in 2018. That was not that long ago, and that was his best season, right? In 2021, he's throwing his fastball 63% of the time, his slider 26% of the time, his changeup 10% of the time, and that's basically it. He has not thrown his sinker once. He's thrown three curveballs all season, and all of them have come in his last two starts. And if you watched him recently, not only is he throwing basically almost just two pitches, his four seam and his slider, it's almost entirely to his glove side. So basically low and inside to lefties and low and outside to righties. It's but the command is so incredible, and the velocity and late movement on the slider and fastball are so good that it almost doesn't matter that he's basically just throwing two pitches. And then once in a while, he'll throw in a changeup just to keep you a little bit off balance. To me, it's just it's incredible to see. Usually what happens with a pitcher when they get older, right? They lose velocity and they add pitches. They become more crafty. You saw Pedro Martinez did this. Felix Hernandez did this. Pitchers who were when they were young, could throw 98, but as they got older, had to become a little more crafty, especially more reliant on their breaking stuff and off speed stuff. And he's kind of the opposite. He's just leaning in to the velocity, and it's kind of incredible.
I have seen a couple of baseball people say, Jacob DeGrom's got a really good curveball. He's thrown it three times this year because he's never needed to bother to. Marcus Stroman tweeted the other day, "What Jacob DeGrom has been doing is nothing short of legendary. Everyone around the league is in awe when he touches the mound. Truly the GOAT of this generation in my eyes. Most humble, chill, approachable dude off the field. Killer on the mound. Thankful to learn from him daily." And Marcus Stroman, I think, is prone to positive things on Twitter. And obviously that's his teammate. And I totally get that. But also, I don't think I could disagree with a single word of that. I'm all in on the Jacob DeGrom as a Hall of Famer discussion. If he wins the Cy this year, that's three. And that's guaranteed. Even if he doesn't, let's say Burns wins it. There are very few times I can think of such dominance like this. This is Pedro 99 or Randy Johnson 2000, or Kershaw 14, Koufax in the 60s. That's what this is. I know that we're living in this high dominance pitching era. This is something else.
And Mike, what's cool is that you and I will both be Hall of Fame voters by the time DeGrom comes up. So we will actually have a say in his candidacy. Last thing I'll mention, DeGrom is pitching Friday night against the Padres, this time at Citi Field. The game is at 7:00, and it is going to be the MLB Network showcase game. So even if you are not in New York or San Diego, you can watch it. It is also the MLB.tv free game of the day. Again, so if you are not in one of those local markets, you can stream that game for free. Jacob DeGrom and the Mets, Fernando Tatis and the Padres. I mean, what's better than that for a Friday night?
Well, I was going to watch it on TV, and now I'm thinking about whether I should get myself up to Queens and actually go see this in person, because that sounds pretty good. We will take a quick break, and we will come back on the Ballpark Dimensions podcast.
This past year has shown us that without your health, you have nothing. If you're not well, you can't work, look after yourself, or take care of your family. You can't enjoy the life you've worked so hard to build. That's why you need to prioritize taking care of your long-term health today, before it goes from good to bad to worse. So invest in your long-term health with Forward. Forward is intelligent medicine with a personal touch. Their doctors are dedicated to catching top killers like cancer and heart disease early, before it's too late. And catching them early could save you tens of thousands of dollars in the long run. Everyone's health history is different, which is why Forward doctors personalize a health plan with you, based on your genetics, lifestyle, and biometrics to achieve long-term results and ensure nothing gets missed. It's time to invest in a doctor that's invested in you. Go to GoForward.com today to protect your future health. That's GoForward.com. GoForward.com.
We are back on the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Each week, Matt and I like to highlight some under-the-radar players. My first guy, I have to apologize a little bit, is not necessarily under the radar. He's probably going to start the All-Star game, but I feel like we needed to talk about him just because we haven't yet. Cedric Mullins, Baltimore outfielder, is really interesting. He right now is hitting 323, 392, 536. So he's hitting 57% better than average. He leads the majors in hits, and he has the second best outs above average in the outfield. Like, he's been a really good guy, and he's had an interesting path. He was a 13th round pick by the Orioles in 2015 from Campbell U. Go Fighting Camels. That's a real thing. They are the Camels. That's awesome. And he wasn't like a totally out of nowhere guy. Like, if you look back at MLB Pipeline's Orioles prospect list entering 2017, he was the number five guy, which is pretty good. Made his debut in 18 and was actually the opening day center fielder for Baltimore in 2019, but not so good. Got into 115 games over 2018 through 2020. And had a 73 OPS plus. And I vaguely remember noticing last year he led the majors in bunt hits, which is like, okay, cool. But over this last winter, he came into the season and he gave up switch hitting. He decided to hit lefty only. And this goes back to the Buck Showalter days in Baltimore that he'd been talking about it. And this year he decided to do it. The results have been fantastic. Like I said, he's been hitting the ball well. He's a really good outfielder. And he's only 26 years old. You know, he turns 27 in October. And it feels like the Orioles have somewhat turned the corner in a sense. I know they had that long losing streak, but I noticed that Baseball America the other day came out with some new rankings. So the Orioles have the number one pitching prospect in baseball and the number one catching prospect in baseball. And Mullins looks like he might be a real guy. John Means looks like he might be a real guy. And if you look at the potential All-Star game roster, well, Means is hurt. So I don't know if he's going to come back and be able to make it. Trey Mancini's a great story, but is he a first base? I don't know. Like, they're Vladimir Guerrero and Yuli Gurriel and Matt Olson. Is he a DH? Well, okay, but JD Martinez and Otani and Yermin and Jordan Alvarez. And if you look at the outfield, Trout's hurt. Buxton's hurt. Laureano's hurt. Aaron Judge will definitely make it. And then it's like Adolis Garcia, Machaniger, Meadows, Marquena, like Teoscar Hernandez. I think Mullins is going to make the All-Star team. He might even start the All-Star team. For an Orioles team that is like finally, maybe, possibly coming out of the wilderness, this is what you need. Not just like your number one overall picks. You need guys to get better internally, and he might be one of those guys.
Yeah, and I've heard, you know, there's been some like, oh, maybe the Orioles would trade him, but he's like 4 years from free agency, and like I think that like he's young enough and good enough that like you'd want to sort of have him part of like, you know, it's, you know, I'm not sure he's part of the next playoff team, but he might be, and like there's no compelling reason right now to trade him, considering that, like, you know, you might just be like kept riding the wave of his prime, and like as some of these prospects come up, you know, like he could be like a centerpiece on a team that starts contending, if not for the division, but maybe for a wild card in a couple of years.
I'm with you. I don't think they'll trade him.
All right, my guy this week is Tigers catcher Eric Haas, which looks like it may be pronounced Hossie, but it's Haas. Thanks, Mike, for that. was called up on May 21st and has been kind of on fire and is like a fun story. And I just wanted to talk about him. You know, last week, Patrick Wisdom won Player of the Week for the Cubs, who is kind of a similar profile out of nowhere guy. And I sort of feel like maybe we need to talk about it, about Eric Haas. He is hitting 274, 329, 671 with 8 home runs, but 6 of those home runs have come in June. We're recording this on June 10th, and he already has 6 home runs. He was called up on May 12th when Grayson Griner hit the IL with a strained left hamstring. He was hitting, you know, he had a 921 OPS in AAA at the time. So, you know, I guess they're like, oh, he's hitting well. Let's bring him up. Here's a fun fact for you. He, according to Baseball Reference, he has a career WAR of 0.7 and his 2021 WAR is 1.2. So he entered the year with negative 0.5 WAR, and he's already put himself into the black on that. He strikes out a lot and doesn't walk a ton. So he kind of has a little bit of like the Mike Zunino profile. And if you look at the barrels per plate appearance leaderboard, he is 7th, minimum 25 balls in play, right behind Mike Zunino. So it is a very fitting profile. He actually originally was drafted by the Indians in the 7th round of the 2011 draft out of high school in Dearborn, Michigan. So he is a local guy. So it's, you know, he's having his breakout with the Tigers, which is cool. Fun thing I noticed is that the Indians first round pick that year in 2011 was Francisco Lindor, and none of the players picked in round 2 through 6 made the major leagues. But then you have Eric Haas in the 7th round, who is now making a name for himself. He was purchased from the Indians in January of 2020, and then the pandemic hit, and he didn't really get to connect with any of his teammates. But he was Matthew Boyd's throwing partner during the shutdown last spring, and he was the only person that Matthew Boyd threw BP to for a while. Here's some from a story from Jason Beck the other day. He said Haas and Boyd could be spotted around area parks playing catch in Detroit since Comerica Park was closed. When they regained access to Comerica, Haas became Boyd's live hitter for batting practice, facing off for as many as 18 at-bats at a time. So it'd be fun to see if ever switch teams and he faces Matthew Boyd in a real game. Anyway, it's just cool to see these guys, random guys. This might be it. This might be his, you know, kind of Chris Shelton moment, but it's, you know, for teams like the Tigers where not a ton of interesting stuff is going on. It's always, cool when players like this emerge, especially when they're a hometown guy.
I always love it when the hometown guy comes up. I was trying to remember why I remembered his name, and I looked back and he had gotten a decent amount of play in 2017. So he was at double A and triple A for Cleveland that year. Only 389 plate appearances, 27 homers, and had a 930 OPS. And I remember him getting written about, like, hey, this guy might be a bat. Cleveland gave him all of 34 plate appearances to prove it. Now, obviously, Roberto Perez is a pretty good catcher for them. But, you know, that's for a team always desperate for offense. You'd think they could have given him a little bit of a better shot. And I agree with you. I don't know that this is a long-term thing, but it's cool because obviously the Tigers need some bats, but anytime you have the hometown guy doing it, that's extra fun. You know what that reminds me of? Totally unrelated. Brandon Crawford just set the Giants all-time record for games played, and he grew up in San Francisco as a Giants fan. There's pictures of him at the ballpark at the stick when he was young. That I just think that's cool.
It is awesome.
We're going to finish up with our purpose pitch. This is where we rant and rave, and I've been waiting for this one for a minute. Listen, the substances and the spin rates, and this is like a whole thing that's going to consume baseball for a while. And, you know, everyone's got lots of opinions of how is this being handled? Should this happen now? What are the right ways to do it, et cetera, et cetera. That's like a much bigger topic that I'm not looking to get into right this second. Here's the thing. Everybody thinks now that they are like a detective of spin rates, you know, because this information is all available in real time on Baseball Savant. For the last week, every time anybody like mildly interesting is pitched, you see people tweeting screenshots and say, well, his spin is down. He must have been caught cheating. And it's like, I'm pulling my hair out here because nobody understands the context of any of this. Here's three important points, right? The first thing is spin rates matter in large quantities. 20 RPMs, literally nothing. 50, nothing. 100, maybe you're getting there. If spin has not gone up or down by at least 100, ignore it, and anybody says that it matters. The second thing is, for a pitcher, spin rates are highly correlated with velocity. So if someone's throwing harder, their spin rate might go up. If they're throwing more softly, spin rate might go down. Like, you have to look at those things in concert. And the third thing is, as much as I love the Hawkeye tracking system that powers StatCast, it is not perfect. You know, if you have one badly tracked pitch that has like a very wonky low spin, especially like in the second inning of a game, that can really screw a guy's average until it's fixed. Or maybe you'll have someone throwing a little slower than usual and it fools the system into thinking as four seamers, maybe his changeup, and that'll get fixed, but in real time, maybe not. So no one is going to like crack the case of the, you know, missing spin rate because you can take screenshots of Baseball Savant. And it's not just fans. I've seen media members who should really know better. There was a radio host in LA was saying, well, the Dodgers have the highest spin rate increase, so they must be cheating. And it's like, okay, dude, but they also traded for or signed Trevor Bauer and cut loose like three low spin guys. I'm not saying none of this is happening. It's clearly happening, but we don't have to like invent ways to try to find things when there are things there. Just understand like the most mild amount of context before we go off on these witch hunts.
Exactly, because teams now self-select players for spin rates,
right?
So it's like, oh, like if a team was like, oh, they just, you know, they're stealing more bases, like they must be cheating. It's like, no, maybe they just signed a bunch of speedsters, or, you know, they're throwing harder. It's like, maybe they just signed a bunch of hard throwing guys. Like, you can't just assume that because it went up that there's some sort of like something nefarious going on.
And to be clear, I'm not saying none of this is happening. Like, it's clearly happening, but just because you have the most spin does not mean that's what's happening.
Totally. I mean, the whole thing in many ways actually does kind of remind me of what happened with PEDs, where it like lurked for a long time and then the players started speaking up about it, and that sort of was like what created the sea change. And like, I'm not necessarily sure that's a bad thing. Like, there just seems to be like the players have sort of finally been like, hey, like, this has become a problem and we need to figure it out. And I think that like, hopefully there will be some sort of some sort of solution that can sort of crack down on this. One thing I will say though is that, like, as kind of is to be expected, offense has been going up as the weather gets warmer. So, like, a lot of the, like, you know, the hand wringing from April, it's like, it's also, we forget that like offense is always lower in April, and that, you know, I checked in like March, April, the league's weighted on base was like 306, but over the last 30 days, it's like 315. So like it's moving up a little bit. And I think that like some of the conversation, you know, it's not going to change the conversation because obviously this is something that needs to be addressed because it is happening. Some of the concerns may have, I don't want to say overwrought, but just like, we're already seeing the shift in like the natural, like, you know, in the run scoring environment as the weather gets warmer.
Yeah. Can I just add a very quick secondary rant on this topic here? I've seen people say, well, this has been happening for years and years and years. Like, why are we caring about this now? I'm not actually saying I would have handled it exactly the same way that it's been handled. I would have some differing opinions on that. But as far as that, like, okay, for 80 years, they're using pine tar and rosin. And now we've got like actual chemists in labs cooking stuff up. And over the, like, why has it changed over the last couple of years? Partially because everybody understands how important spin rate is now. Not that like you couldn't eyeball this years ago and say, oh, that curveball moves a lot, but now you can measure it and say, oh, if I can up my spin by 300 RPMs, that might get me more strikeouts. Like, things have changed over the last couple of years. This is an old problem that has really like ramped up over the last 2 or 3 years. So why is it different now? That is why it's different now.
Well said. All right. My rant, and I'll keep this quick. You might have seen on Monday night, there were actually two sons of former big leaguers who missed bases on home runs, which was like one of the weirdest things ever. One of which was Ke'Bryan Hayes for the Pirates, which was actually kind of obvious and it was visible on replay. So there wasn't really anything you could say about it. Although I felt bad for him because like the only reason he missed the base is because like the ball climbed back on the field off the foul pole and it was unclear if it was a home run or if he would have to sprint. Like if he knew it was a home run all the way, he never would have missed the base. So I sort of felt bad for him. It was kind of a weird one. But in the minors, a ridiculous one happened where Bobby Witt Jr. hit his second home run of the game, the Royals prospect playing in Double-A for Northwest Arkansas. And as he was, you know, coming across home plate, he did like his little like shimmy, like, you know, across home plate, which I have no problem with. Hey, celebrate home runs. Home runs are fun. And the catcher pointed out, hey, maybe he missed home plate. And they appealed and the umpire called him out for missing home plate. Beyond the fact that like on other angles, it looks like he might have actually touched home plate. It was just absolutely ridiculous. Like there's no reason the umpire should insert themselves in their game right there. It like doesn't matter like if he may or may not have like slightly missed home plate. It wasn't like a bang bang play at the plate where they're trying to tag him where actually touching home plate is like changes the context of the moment and the play. This was a home run hit 440 feet. And there's like nothing worse than when officials in any sports will like unnecessarily insert themselves into the game when they don't have to. Like, I don't care if he may have like not, if he might have missed the plate by like a fraction of an inch. Like, it's ridiculous. It shouldn't have happened. That's all I have to say about that.
Oh, I don't want to be a total buzzkill here, but like, that's the rule. You got to touch. Let me ask you this. Did it change the context of anything that Ke'Bryan Hayes didn't touch first base? Like, but you still got to call him out.
I mean, that's I think that one is, I almost put in a wholly separate category because it was like so weird and I felt bad for him. Like, yes, you had to call him out because the video was there. He clearly missed it. But like, I also think that he kind of got screwed because if the umpire just ruled home run, he would have obviously touched the base. He was confused because he was like, oh, do I have to sprint now? That one is like a whole weirdness one. Like the Bobby Witt Jr. one was like, he's just running the bases. It was a home run. There's no dispute. Like it was just silly. Not to mention the fact that he looks like he actually touched the plate.
Well, it's funny. I saw like the primary angle. Everybody saw it. It definitely looked like he touched home plate and everybody lost their minds. And then I saw someone tweet a secondary angle where it's like, I'm not so sure he actually touched home plate. You know what the funniest thing about the Ke'Bryan Hayes one was to me? Imagine the best player on the team hitting a home run, missing first base and getting the home run called back and not having it even be the weirdest first base related thing on your team in the last 3 weeks. because of the whole Will Craig, Javi Baez incident. And by the way, Will Craig got DFA'd not long after that. So remember to touch first base whenever you possibly can on offense or defense. That is the first rule of baseball. That'll do it for this week's podcast. Don't miss an episode by subscribing at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thank you for listening to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. We'll see you next week.
Talking about erectile dysfunction isn't easy. Usually we just brush it off or blame ourselves, saying things like, I lost my mojo. Or we avoid it altogether with excuses like, I had a long day at work, or sorry, honey, I'm just not feeling it. But with Roman, it is easy to talk about. with a real healthcare professional who can prescribe real medication. It's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free two-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/MLB and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/MLB today. If approved, you'll get $15 off your first order of ED treatment. Roman is the official partner of Major League Baseball. That's GetRoman.com/MLB. GetRoman.com/MLB.